happening now? Interested.
Restream is all looking good. I don't see it on YouTube yet. And given we're doing
I'm looking on the Facebook.
We're doing the self-service today.
I'm on Facebook. I want to at least see it. Is it going to be a video on Facebook or just a link?
Hang on. I've got a warning.
Oh, it's a link. Okay. Oh, so it doesn't actually stream inside Facebook. It's a television show.
Oh, okay. Facebook is now online, according to Restream.
Like Facebook is video?
It's an event.
And YouTube should now be online, according to... Yep, I see myself on... Woo! This is good. And Twitch is still sending. We're waiting for Twitch to come online.
I don't get it.
Come on.
Yeah, actually, I don't see how Facebook...
Yeah, I don't think... When you say Facebook is live...
I don't know any more than that.
It just says click here and it says live at ASP.net. Yeah. But when you click it, it doesn't actually do anything.
Well, Restream is sending it to an RTMP endpoint, and Twitch should now be online. Which it is! We're live everywhere, according to Restream. That's good enough for me. So...
Wonderful.
If someone wants to keep looking at Facebook and figuring out where it is, we can do that. All right, well, welcome everybody. We are self-service this week in the studio, so I apologize for us being 10 minutes late. I had to plug in devices and get passwords and all that type of stuff, but we are running, and it seems we're doing stuff that's new for the first time. So apparently it's going to Facebook, although no one knows what that means yet, so Scott's going to figure that out, though. I can see us on Twitch, I can see us on YouTube, and for the first time ever, I believe, the guests on Teams here can actually see what's happening in real time on the show. So
this is a huge deal because normally we're pretending like you're showing a demo and we're like nodding our head like, but we actually have like a 15 second delay.
That's right. So
no longer.
Wonderful.
Awesome. And everyone's saying the sound is awesome. So hopefully this will be the best show ever. All right. How are you, Scott?
I'm okay. I got back late last night from South by Southwest in an event in Fort Wayne, Indiana. So I'm going to end up getting in trouble because I'm going to end up working 12 days in a row because I didn't have a weekend. So I need to work on my work-life balance now. But otherwise, I got a new shirt.
I like a new shirt.
From Bria Sullivan on her new t-shirt.
Back other way. There we go. Get bread.
No, man. Get this bread, man.
Get this bread? I'm not. Sorry, I don't
money,
get
it. Money.
Get this money. Okay. Nice. Very nice. I like
it. No one appreciates my t-shirts.
Sorry. I'm sorry. John, how are you?
I put up with your Australianisms.
What? What Australianisms? Hang on. This has to be addressed.
So it's every few sentences is some Australian.
I found us on Facebook, by the way. We're on the .net. So it's Facebook.net. And then
on the .net?
Yeah, so we're trying to do, because we do Tuesday and Thursday, and we're trying to coordinate things, so we do the events are all created on the .net Facebook, and then shared from the...
So can you help me? I'm on Facebook.
Literally,
what do I do? Do I just search for .net?
Facebook. Don, there's a guy on Facebook right now saying, how do we listen in on the Standbook?
It's a great question.
Hang on, then you said you found it.
You said you found
it. I did find it.
Okay.
I'm trying to finish the sentence. I need to finish an entire sentence in order to get this across. If you go to facebook.com/dotnet, you will see a thing on the left side where it has videos.
So I am looking at the event right now in Facebook. I did a search. It was the second result. I'm looking at a thing called web.net community stand-up march.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to find how I look at
them. The issue is there's no way to figure it out. From the event and the video are not linked.
So that's true. What we'll do, this is our first time. I didn't even know it was going to happen until we were setting it up. So if you go to facebook.com/.net.
/ videos.
Yeah.
So it's DOTNET?
/.
Yeah, there slash video.
Yeah, okay. It works.
And then where's
that's
video?
Really a thing.
We'll fix up links in the future. We'll get this going.
So where's videos?
Left side. Home, post, reviews, videos.
I don't have videos. I have home post reviews photos. I'm not kidding.
So there's a link that I put in the Teams chat.
But I'm trying to help other people get there.
No, look at my screen.
Yeah, because I'm going to... Okay. Mine does not look like that. Let me hit F5. Mine does not look like that.
Yeah, it says live right there.
Yeah, mine does not show that. Yeah, let me show you my screen.
I think .net Facebook blocked.
Here's my screen.
Do you like it? Like it first.
Oh, I have to like it first?
You don't have to like it. If you don't like it, then you're blocked.
Okay, hang on. I liked it.
Yeah.
I liked
now
it.
Hit refresh. I'm guessing here, by the way.
No. No.
Huh.
I am following it.
Hit slash videos, just out of curiosity. Maybe there's a permission.
This content isn't available right now. The link is expired.
That's weird. And you're logged in?
Yeah, that's my name up there.
Huh. It's weird because there's like 5 people on it.
Yeah.
You know, I clicked videos, John, and it says no videos to show.
Wow.
I think it may have died.
Oh, well. It was a good idea while it was.
It was fun.
Oh, there it is. So, nope. Yep, it's broken now.
Huh.
Never mind.
Well,
okay.
Well, no, hang on. Do it out of curiosity, Damien.
Yes.
Hit Facebook /.net/videos manually.
I did.
And it doesn't.
And it told me this content isn't available right now. The link may have expired.
Scandalous.
I wonder, yeah.
Well, there's 2 people there that are enjoying it very much. So.
Yeah, this is cool. People are watching live. They're like, what's your problem?
Brian's like, well.
As long as you two can see their comments.
Support both of them. Now, Google Plus.
All right. Well, that's enough of mucking around with the video, which is the usual first 5 minutes anyway.
Well, I'm going to share this on your timeline, Danny.
Thank you. Yeah. John, do you love the community this week? Please tell me you do.
I do love the community. Yeah. Okay. Just a second. I'm finishing sharing on your timeline. Great. Okay.
Excellent. John, I would like to add you to my professional network.
Oh, how do we get on LinkedIn? Okay.
That's actually not a bad idea.
All right. I'll look into that.
Oh, dear.
Who sees my page? Who sees my screen?
Yeah, it's all good, mate. Go for it.
Wonderful, wonderful. Okay, so
there's one of those Australianisms that Scott was talking about. Sorry.
I'll think of one. If I catch you doing one, else.
I just said that thing. It's looking good, mate. Go for it.
Yeah. That was.
When you say
Crikey,
that.
Crikey, look at that one.
Yeah, what about Bloomin' Onions? Do you guys do Bloomin' Onions there?
No, that's not
it's
a thing.
Even Australian.
That's the Outback Steakhouse. I'm pretty sure that's a thing. So this, I forget even how this came up last time. We were talking about like initializing a repo and stuff, and somebody, a few people shared, but this was one somebody wrote up. This is kind of cool. It's a license picker and stuff.
Show me. What is the layout it ends up doing? Is it the sanctioned one true layout for .NET?
Well, it does an editor config. It does the standard git ignore. You pick your license. So it's basically getting the 3 dot files, the license and the readme ready
does
for
it,
you.
Does it do the solution layout, though?
No, it doesn't.
I don't think so.
I would love to help them do that. I'd really love to get that done.
That's part of my...
the command line. That would be amazing.
Yeah, very cool.
All right.
So Jahed, continuing the series, I've been like brainstorming. I love it. He calls me up and he'll be like, hey, what do you think of this? And, you know, I actually had some requests for this that he put in. So here he's talking about JavaScript in ASP.NET Core. So he talks about middleware, talks about, you know, handling static files and the interaction of static files, middleware with authentication as well, right? Then he goes through and talks about customizing locations. So this is neat that you can customize at the program level, or you can do it also in the middleware level. And he points out that you can set both the path, you know, your on-disk path, and also the virtual path. So this is a neat thing to be aware of. Yep. Then he goes through and talks about actually things like integrity, right? So you've got your CDN integrity and how the tag helper works with that. So verifying your cross-origin integrity. So that is a good thing. And then finally wrapping up with libman. So showing, you know, getting files on disk using libman, pulling from a CDN and putting them in your directory and kind of configuring that. So I've been using libman a lot lately. I'm a fan. All right. So here's Brady and Cecil talking about SignalR. So this is a really cool ASP.NET Core SignalR overview. They cover, you know, introduction, go through different, you know, kind of getting started stuff. I like this here. He goes through the background service and the Azure SignalR service and all this stuff, you know, GitHub links for all this. So fresh, new, exciting SignalR content. This is great, too. It's a half hour. And
another thing worth pointing out there, if you scroll down just a little bit, that I always think that people don't appreciate enough about SignalR. She said the SignalR Java client on Android. SignalR is not a .NET thing for .NET people to do .NET stuff, right? It has a Java client. It can run on a mobile device. It is the everything format for everyone on every device. So that's just right. Worth pointing that out.
Well, not only that, you can take it further, and that if you don't even have to own a .NET server, you don't even have to have an app that you've written in .NET at all, you can host code using like node code in Azure Functions that reacts and has a, what is this trigger they have set up now for the Signaler service. So you can have all the Signaler stuff just running on the serverless platform, the Signaler as a service, and then mm-hmm. you can talk to clients of any language and coordinate messaging from any language through Azure Functions. And then you've got a full real-time serverless sort of architecture going on without any .NET code running at all that you wrote. So pretty flexible today.
Yeah. Yep. Amazing. So fun to see Brady in on this, and Cecil does an amazing job with .NET show, so very good stuff. This one is pretty neat, continuing on the discussion from, you know, when we had David on talking about performance, and this is a really cool like deep dive into performance tricks and working through a pull request. Oh, awesome, thank you. Working through a pull request on .NET string optimization. So here the deal is there's this thing encoding characters. So this is encoding a 32-bit string or a 32 encoding a long string. Yeah, long into a 32 character string. And so I was like, why the heck would you do that? And you actually, you can see there's three places here. There's a request identifier, a GUID, and a correlation ID. So those are three times that this is used. Mm-hmm. So he kind of goes through and works through. He started with, I'm just going to use span. So he goes through and starts with using span. And then every single step here, I mean, I learned stuff or was reminded of stuff on every single step. It was really cool. So looking at string.create as opposed to just, you know, creating it in line, right?
Right.
Then reversing the assignation order. So this is allows you to skip bounds checks
yep.
if you reverse the order. So every step here, you know, I'm not going to go through every single deal, but it was really, really cool. And he shows for each of these how things got better. So one point is, like, for instance, we had, starting at the beginning, we're casting everything to an int. And down here he's saying, well, we can get rid of that explicit cast. Instead of using a string, we'll use a char array, right? So then at the very end of it, going from original 34 nanoseconds, which is still pretty fast, down to 17.
But
so,
they add up, John. They add up.
Yeah, they do. They totally do. You're right.
Now,
you're right.
There's a little history with this one. As you said, there's three places where we do this inside ASP.NET Core. And I remember all the way back in 1.0 when we were starting to really look at performance and, you know, looking at these, how could you possibly get 1 million requests per second? That's crazy. And now we're at like 7 million. But some of the things, well, 4 million for ASP.NET Core with middleware. These, if you're going to have a trace identifier for every single request, you need to generate a unique ID, and then you need to somehow turn that into a value that you can echo out to the screen, you can put in logs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it has to be incredibly fast to do so. So, you know, you can have a long and you can increment it and do that type of stuff, and that's cheap and fast enough, but then turning that into a string value so that you can actually emit that to a log was where things get complicated. So this whole, oh, well, if it's going to be 32 characters, you've basically got a base 32 language there. What's the fastest way of turning a long into base? And so that's where that initial bit shifting code that he uses at the top, I think it was,
right.
So the very original code, there's that section there. So that's a whole bunch of fancy math, right? It's bit shifting binary math to take that original number and then turn that into a alphanumeric representation using that array of buffers, which is your alphabet, right? Base 32. That's the alphabet up the top. 32 different characters we can use to represent.
It's interesting here too, showing even that is 310% faster than calling long to string.
Which is what we started out doing, and then we see that in the profiles, and we built this. And I remember, I think it was Lou and Ben and a whole bunch of folks who figured this out, and then since then, even we can go even faster. And so that's what the span and the string.create and stuff. So it, you know, generally, you don't have to worry about this stuff. But when you're trying to do stuff millions of times a second, turning longs into strings, because .NET does encoding by default that's globalization aware and all that type of thing, that all has a cost. That sometimes involves looking up information from the OS if you're on Windows, because the locale is owned by the OS. And so, you know, there is cost associated with doing that. So that's why this type of very specialist code ends up existing. What has happened is when we've done these things a lot of the times, people like Ben then go and look at these optimizations, and then they look at the rest of the entire .NET framework, like the .NET CoreFX BCL, and they look for opportunities to apply this to like all the helper methods that exist. And so we've had situations where, you know, the enum helper methods that create you the string names from the number and vice versa and stuff, he's applied all this type of magic to those methods too. So now even the most basic string manipulation methods that we've been using for 15 years are now hundreds of times faster than they used to be, which is great.
It's really cool, really cool. Yeah. Neat. Okay, so here is Andrew Locke talking about why isn't session state working in ASP.NET Core. This is really interesting, looking at the interaction of GDPR and how GDPR works with session. And so working through a simple case, I noticed last time we featured his blog that he's got this light dark toggle, and a way of implementing that is setting a session variable, right? The problem is you can run into something where code that used to work for you in ASP.NET Core 2.0, where, you know, and he walks through here first, let's set up session and let's store the information in session. So this code works here. This is a click stream here, but you know, clicking on home and about and contact, and it's storing all that stuff in session. Taking that exact same code and running that in ASP.NET Core 2.1 or 2.2 is not preserving that history. And what the heck is going on? And the issue is that GDPR, the session cookie is non-essential. And so until you accept that GDPR dialogue, which if you're like me, sometimes your brain just filters that out. You don't even see it there anymore, yeah. You know? So until you accept that, it doesn't work. I mean, quote unquote, doesn't work, right?
Right.
So here he explains why that is. And then he goes through and says, what are your options? So option one is deal with it, you know, this, accept the existing behavior. Option two is realize which things are optional behaviors, and you can disable those. They're maybe not necessary or not necessary to store in session. Option three, and there's two things here. One is disable the cookie consent requirement. You got to be careful in here, and as he points out, you may think you're you probably do need to care about GDPR.
I think he says seek advice.
Yes, he does. And he actually points out to Troy Hunt's article on this. So yeah, definitely, you know, this is something that maybe if you're on an intranet or you're doing something very specific and you know you're okay to do this, but just it's not something to just go and do, right? But you can toggle that. Mm-hmm. And then finally, there is a thing where you can mark a session cookie as essential. This is part of the GDPR middleware, the cookie.
We don't have a GDPR middleware. We have cookie policy.
Yes, cookie policy. Yeah. So you can actually set whether a cookie is essential or not.
That's right.
Some cookies are essential, right? The site doesn't work. A light dark toggle, I wouldn't really put that in that level, but that is something you can do. So those are your four options.
Right. Yeah,
this is actually something I had run into kind of recently, and it was nice seeing his clear explanation, because I was like, oh, I'll just do this thing and I'll save it in a cookie, and why is it not working? And I was like,
So just to be clear, it also impacts temp data, which he calls out in this blog post.
That was actually the case I ran into.
Right, because temp data defaults from 2.1 forwards in storing its data in cookies of its own rather than in session, because session requires you to set up a store, so we changed it to use cookies, but they're obviously marked non-essential by default. The other thing is you won't hit this unless you create a new project starting from 2.1 or forward. So like this isn't like some transparent behavior or flag that just appears in your application once you start running on 2.1 or above. This was a lot of code in the template as well. We added features, like we already had the cookie policy middleware. We expanded our cookie abstraction to support the concept of essential. We added a new HTTP feature that tracks consent, so the idea of the user having given consent, which itself is tracked in its own cookie, which is a bit of a chicken and egg, which is funny. And then we added code to the template to give you that UI and a privacy policy page, and then the coordination of all those things together to give you this experience, which a lot of folks, as a result of GDPR, have implemented in their site. Like, there's no GDPR paragraph that I'm aware of that says you must have a banner that does this or anything. It's not how it works, but this is a very common pattern we're seeing people do. Now, this is always what you get with a 2.1 plus ASP.NET Core web application if you choose the web application template. In 3.0, we're actually going to put this behind an option. And so you'll be able, this will still be in the template, but you'll be able to turn it off. You'll be able to, you know, submit a parameter during file project creation to say, no, I don't want all the cookie policy stuff. And we're still debating whether we default it to on or off. In VS, that option would be sticky, obviously. So once you've selected it, it remembers it. But I just want to let people know that that's one change we're making here in 3.0.
Cool. All right. This is an issue that I just saw. Nick Craver had posted this. And I don't know if you want to jump in on this at all, Damien. This was something that they said has been very useful for them to upgrade to ASP.NET Core.
We're actually doing this as a direct response to them saying we can't upgrade to Core because we use at functions so much. And they use it in a way that we had not anticipated people were using it. So you can talk this and I'll talk a little bit about the history.
Well, yeah, I mean, basically they had existing in ASP.NET Razor, they had markup in their functions. I actually had trouble finding a good place. Like, you can dig through tests and you can find some stuff.
That feature didn't exist before. So what happened is we had a couple different ways in Razor originally to do like fragments of Razor that you could reuse throughout the app or in the library.
Yeah.
One of them, you know, partials, which we know today, and you invoke them as a partial, and we do have those in Core. Which has some overhead associated with doing it, because each partial is its own view. So when you say render this partial, it's like an entirely new view rendering context that gets created. We had helpers, which was what Stack Overflow is using today, and where you would have a helpers folder with an at and a bunch of CSHTML files with at helper at the top of them. And then you would just, that helper then be basically gets turned into a function that you can call from any Razor file in your application. And that was just magic. That was part of Web Pages, the framework that we had, you know, 8 years ago. But the other thing we had was these Razor fragments. It was like a Razor expression delegate or something. It had some weird name. I think the only person who ever blogged about them was Phil Hack, and he was the PM for the feature.
Yes.
And it basically, if you know this special Lambda expression signature, you can create a delegate in line that is literally a snippet of Razor that you can then invoke like a function. Now, the problem is they're synchronous only, which meant it was very hard for us to retrofit that syntax and that directive into the new Razor engine, which is actually async. And then the other problem, as Nick has just pointed out in the chat, is that they weren't using helpers the way that we designed them to be used and we thought everyone was using them, which is they create a file, they put stuff in there, and then that method turns up everywhere. What they are doing is that whenever they have a large view and they have little bits of Razor that is replicated or repeated in that one view, they would just create a local helper in that one file. So you have a view, and like you could create a private function inside your C# class and then call that multiple times in one type, but it's private. They were doing that with helper. And they use that extensively throughout Stack Overflow. It's a large code base, obviously. And the reason they do that is performance. There's virtually no cost or overhead of that componentization model where you have a Razor helper delegate in the actual view. It literally gets code emitted as just a function call. So it's incredibly cheap. All the other mechanisms, tag helpers, view components, partials, you name it, they're all vastly more expensive in terms of runtime performance. And so we worked with them to, rather than just say, let's bring back helper, because helper has a whole bunch of problems, like I said, because of the synchronous, asynchronous thing. We've designed a new feature, which we think is better, which is basically, hey, take the at functions block, which has existed in Razor forever, and let you put methods in there, private methods, that can return Razor fragments. So just like have a method that inside of it you have Razor, and it'll return, as long as you have the right return type, it'll return HTML content, basically. And so that's what we're doing here. And the advantage that will make it work with async, it can be void returning for synchronous, it can be task and async await for asynchronous stuff, and then, so that's what's in here. And that's hopefully going to land in preview 4, and I think it's in PR right now, so still being built.
Very cool. All right, I will try and speed up. I've apparently brought a lot of links in that have a lot of interesting background and stuff. Okay, so this one, Damian Bowden, here he's talking about running Razor Pages and gRPC service together in the same ASP.NET Core application. The thing that I picked up out of this is that there's a switch here, HTTP protocols, HTTP 1 and 2. gRPC is HTTP 2. And so running both inside the same app, that is kind of a toggle there. The rest of this relatively straightforward, turning on the middleware, setting up static file hosting and stuff. But so I thought that was interesting.
Cool.
This is something that was just released in open source today. This is Accessibility Insights. So the reason I thought this was interesting, this is a Microsoft thing that they did, and it allows you, there's a Windows and a Chrome extension that'll go through and it checks your site for all kinds of issues. So I installed the Chrome extension. Here's a look at, this is our dearly beloved conference planner app.
Yay.
Yeah, so here if I click on this, then I can go and run a FastPass, and you'll see, yeah, so what I found out in the sites I ran, basically everyone, you're going to get these code contrast issues, and okay. They'll say,
good.
Yeah. So,
did you by any chance happen to run it on file new?
I did.
Oh, good. Did you log all the bugs?
I did not yet.
If I can add a couple of things, because I work with this team.
Yeah.
What this is doing is this is a front end UI and a series of UI UX improvements on top of a well-known accessibility tool called Axe, mm-hmm. by a company called DQ Systems, DEQUE. And if you can click on tab stops, if you have a form and hit show tab stops, and then what it'll do is start pressing tab.
Wonderful. Oh, wow.
That is so pretty.
Isn't that
Hey, they're
amazing?
Actually pretty good.
Well, it's because we don't do anything stupid to override them.
Yeah,
we just
don't, exactly.
We have the content is linear, and we let the browser do its job.
So the point there is to assert your assumptions and understand how you move through a mm-hmm. system. So go ahead and go back to the tool.
Mm-hmm.
They've also going to have a Windows version. So there's the doing the Windows version, and then click on the FastPass dropdown.
Yeah,
this one assessment. FastPass is the basic. Look on the left.
Wow.
You will have a list of a million different things to go and take a look at. If you go back to automated checks, it'll give you a big long list of what it's going to go and do. And then along the left hand side, it'll tell you, you know, you can do a visual helper. So click on visual helper. On the right-hand side, right there. So then go back to your page. You want to have these things snapped, right? And then hover over one of those.
Yeah, it's amazing, huh?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing to say that there's potentially a contrast issue or whatever. So yeah, you want to have that snapped to one side. It's a really, really friendly way to put things on top of open source Axe. In 5 minutes, you can do the fast pass. Everybody should get this and install it. And it's all up at the accessibility GitHub, and check it out. Yeah, aka.ms/accessibility-insights.
That's so cool.
I'm going to blog about it later on, but the team has been working very hard on that, and you should definitely check it out.
One thing that I noticed, Damian, that is something I should, I guess, file a bug on. Well, I don't know.
Well, okay, you should just file it either way, whether you know or not, right? It'll either get closed or something will happen. But
the Alan's language been... attribute, but...
The language attribute? Okay. What about it?
That is a required thing that wants you to specify a language attribute. Mm-hmm. Now I'm English centric, and I'm like, well, of course I'll fix this by putting EN here.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess our templates are mostly English localized by default, but
yeah, they're English.
That is one thing.
Well, I think what you would want to do instead would be to figure out whether you need a tag helper for HTML and whether or not it would do it for you, right?
So, well, no. Based on what? That's a trap that we have to current, that people fall into.
Well, so then the question is then based on current context, current culture?
No, because you can't determine the language of the site based on who's visiting you, right? Like, you have to actually localize your site.
You have to go and sniff for it, decide what you support, what they support, make a list of here are the things that they would like, here are the things that you'd support.
So let's be clear, that's an incredibly complicated feature, and we have absolutely no plans to build something like that. What I'm saying is that the templates themselves, which are static content, if we localize those into other languages, Then obviously we can include the lang field, and we can make sure that the for the 16 languages, whatever that we do VS localization into, that would put the right thing in there based on whatever that template is produced. When it comes to a larger effort to do globalization and localization for your website, you decide as the website owner, how many languages am I going to localize into, how many locales and cultures am I going to support, and then that is a vastly more complicated set of problems, which I know you know.
No, I understand. And so, I understand it is. I think the point is to be conscious of the fact that these are, in fact, problems that you
absolutely.
Should be aware of.
Absolutely.
And the option, you know, and it can be as simple as, well, I only support English, therefore Lang equals
yes.
EN.
Yeah.
Or it can be as clever and sophisticated as the intersection of what I support and what they support and the weighted list of all of the things involved in an HTTP.
Yeah, that is and systems that do that are generally fairly complex and quite involved. Mm-hmm. And every website tends to do it themselves.
It was not fun to do that when I was in banking.
Right. And you'll know, for example, like even the Microsoft.com addresses, I think today, they still have the approach of changing the URL based on the language and the geo that you're coming from. And now not every website does that. Some websites hide or do not promote or visualize the locale or globe information in the URL, but others do, and I couldn't tell you off the top of my head what is considered best practice. There might be arguments about that, I don't know. But Microsoft.com, for better or worse, does do that. So.
Cool. All right. For this, just real quick shout out, we onboarded some new things to .NET Foundation. One, including one you should be aware of, is Mini Profiler.
Woo-hoo!
So, Mini Profiler is just a great way to get insights in your page and, you know, understand performance and all that. So. Really nice thing. So wrapping up here with two blog posts. There's a relatively long one on Blazor 0.9.0, and then a super long one on stuff in Preview 3, .NET Core, or ASP.NET Core updates in .NET Core 3.0, Preview 3, September refresh. So I don't know if you want me to go through any of this stuff, Damien, or I mean, some of this stuff.
I would love to talk about this. We've touched on a few of these things already, but this, now that Preview 3 is out, and the team, while I was away, did this amazing, because I was in Hawaii, did this amazing blog post that talks about all the great features that we landed in Preview. I'm so happy with this release, because the first couple of previews for ASP.NET Core, we were just kind of catching up after shipping 2.2, because ASP.NET Core was the team that did the most work in the .NET Core 2.2 release. Most of the rest of the .NET Core team were focusing on the 3.0 leading up to Preview 1. And so ASP.NET Core didn't have a lot in Preview 1 at all. Then there was a little bit in Preview 2, but Preview 3 is where we've really hit the ground and we've got a whole bunch of stuff landing. So I was super happy to see this. And so we've talked about a few of these things already, right? We showed some gRPC stuff, we showed some worker stuff. Obviously, Razor components, a lot of folks are following along, but we've finally got the first drop of what forms and validation might look like with a whole bunch of changes to the event handling. Class library projects have been updated to support Razor components. Pre-rendering support landed. Blazor experimental releases have now aligned with Razor components in 3.0. So there is a Blazor release that lines up with this release of Preview of .NET Core 3. So the components in that Blazor app are Razor components from .NET Core 3, Preview 3, if that makes sense. We did some template stuff. Like we simplified the Razor components template down to one project rather than two. We've got the runtime compilation package is back for Razor. So if you want the Razor runtime compilation feature, which got removed from the SDK, which we announced a while ago, that's now available back as a package again, so you can get that feature back again. The Angular template got updated to Angular 7. We finally dropped the first public preview of the identity server integration that we've been talking about, it seems like, for half a year now. We were originally planning to get that done post 2.2 in a set of out-of-band packages. We still are maybe going to do that, but right now that work is in the 3.0, like in the SDK. If you install 3.0, you'll get a template that lets you create a SPAR application with a SPAR-based identity and authentication, including the server-side piece, which is identity server-based in an ASP.NET Core application with a new set of Glue code that the ASP.NET Core team wrote and shipped as a package. That's kind of simplifies setting up identity server specifically for this scenario, and then we plan to extend that over time. So that's now available as well. What else was there? You went away from the summary.
No, I did. Let me go back to the top. Right. Signalr.
And then the Signalr stuff, we got the endpoint route. Signalr is now works with endpoint routing so that you configure all your Signalr routes in the endpoint routing stage of the middleware setup, which is great. And we got the giant, the Java client for Signalr now supports long polling so that if you don't have web sockets, it'll fall back to long polling. So much great stuff landed in this release, which I'm so happy to see. And there's work under the covers, like even enabling the worker service template required a bunch of work on generic host. We've seen lots of good feedback to this. It's been a really, really good release. I've seen some great blog posts, lots of tweets saying people are enjoying it. Oh, we got the Razor extension too. Finally.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about that.
So the Razor extension, and I know some people, I know Yanni in the chat here has some opinions on this, but the Razor extension was something that we originally wanted to do when we did Razor Pages back in 2.0, but I'm glad we didn't because the Razor component model is a different compilation model. When you build Razor components versus Razor views, and Razor views and pages are the same from a compilation point of view, they compile very differently. And there are different restrictions in the languages, literally in the Razor grammar, because you can do things in Razor components that you can't do in Razor pages and views and vice versa. And so up until this point where we had a new extension, we had to tell the Razor compiler which .cshtml files were Razor components and which ones were Razor pages. Otherwise, we would have had to do some fairly awful things like add new directives, which we didn't want to do, and a whole bunch of stuff. So now we have a specific extension. The .razor extension means Razor component. Okay, and that means you'll get a much more curated, fantastic developer experience because the editor knows it's a Razor component file, so it'll only give you IntelliSense and errors and compilation checking and stuff for Razor components. And .cshtml files are the existing Razor engine, Razor views, partials, layouts, et cetera, and you'll get the experience for that. Now, you can integrate them, and you can have them both in the same project now super easily. And you can take a Razor component, which compiles to a type, and then you can render that from a Razor view using a helper function, which is in this release. And so there's lots of good stories now regarding the Razor stuff, so it's really cool.
Wow. All right, that's all my links.
Nice. Let's go back to our split screen, hey?
Yes.
So right. I there was a couple of questions, but we'll prompt people now. Please ask any questions if you want myself or Scott or John to answer them. I saw someone asking about gRPCs. I'm going to scroll back, and I'm going to answer that one first. Let's have a look. I went too far. Someone asked a question after they were talking.
I'm gonna have to get going in about 5-10 minutes.
Okay.
We're taking Taekwondo.
Oh, nice.
So I have to get ready.
When you say we're, you are as well?
It's one of those things where the children have been signed up for this thing and my wife has told me that sitting and watching them kick things is not allowed.
Oh.
So I am also doing it.
Oh, you're gonna do as well.
Which is ironic because I did it 25 years ago, so it's all coming back to me.
Nice.
But I'm also a bit of a slap fighter. So I understand that when you're doing Taekwondo, if you just drop to the ground and go, stop with the kicking, that it's not appreciated by the people. But
that's fine. Yeah. Okay, so someone asked, Greg Ingram asked, can you give details on roadmap thoughts for new gRPC tooling, better support building client APIs, Signalr support, etc.? Good stuff, by the way. Okay, so we had previously, so right now in the preview 3 for Core 3.0, there is a gRPC template, which I think we've shown on the show in the last couple of weeks, and there is a MS build-based experience which is proto first, because that's the gRPC way. You define your contracts first using protobuf files, .proto files, and then you some tool chain will generate you a server and a client, right? Or a client, like you get to decide at tooling time what you want. And that is how gRPC works, right? We've had some customers say, can you do a code-first approach, da-da-da-da? And, we debated that, and we decided that, because we're basically helping the gRPC team by building an ASP.NET Core implementation of gRPC and then contributing it to that project, we didn't want to walk in there and go, oh, you're doing it wrong. Who wants to do proto-first? You should be doing code-first. We recognize that there are some .NET customers who are used to a code-first approach, but we want to first nail the proto-first approach, the spec-first approach, which is what the entire gRPC community is built around, before we decide or start investigating whether a third model for .NET gRPC is warranted. Because to be clear, the existing gRPC for .NET is going to remain, which is basically a whole bunch of native code with a very thin .NET layer on top. And then there's the gRPC for ASP.NET Core, which is what we're building and it ships in the box in .NET Core 3, but
those libraries are part of the Google gRPC project. And then what that other thing we're talking about would be a whole other thing, which we're not going to get to right now. So in terms of tooling, right now you get an MS Builder-based experience. You do your proto file. There's some references of that in your CS proj, a proto ref, and then you tell it if you want to generate a client or a server or both. You tell it what those proto files are, and then your magic happens as part of the build, and it generates some files, and you inherit from those, and that's how you build it. It's pretty cool. We're going to improve that experience, obviously. We want to, it's a very similar experience to what we wanted for REST-based APIs or HTTP APIs as well, whereby you could have an open API or a Swagger endpoint, and then you could generate client code from that. And we talked about that again in the 2.2 timeframe, but we haven't been able to get that work finished to ship it. That work is now again part of 3.0. We may or may not get the ability to release that to work on earlier versions. We're still trying to figure that out. It's just more work, but we're working on that right now. So there's an opportunity for alignment there. So we're going to utilize, if we can, the same mechanisms, the same MS build glue, and the same idioms for referencing some type of spec, proto file, an open API or slash Swagger endpoint, a Swagger document, a P2P to another project that has an ASP.NET Core Swagger endpoint in it. Right, so you don't have to do everything spec first. You just say, look, there's my API. It's in this project. I have a client. Just make it work, please. So we're going to do that. And then get that aligned between the gRPC experience and the OpenAPI HTTP experience. So things will look similar. And then do the VS work. So you can say, hey, add a reference, service reference from this client to this server, and fiddle with that using a GUI and stuff. And it'll do the MS build stuff for you. And a CLI experience as well. So there'll be a .NET add service reference or proto reference or whatever it might be, and you'll be able to drive all this from the .NET CLI as well. So that's our plans for tooling regarding gRPC, is closer alignment with the work that we were going to do or doing for client gen of OpenAPI slash Swagger stuff, and then obviously CLI and VS experience to support that as well. So hopefully that answers that question. Let me scroll down and see if there's any questions. Any plans for content security policy support in the box? I found a couple of new gets. Was wondering if the team is planning to support this. I've seen this bubble up a couple of times. My understanding of the general answer is that I'm not sure. So Scott's off. We're not sure what we would actually do that adds value here. So our templates, like set content hashes and things like that, for the content that we have. But setting a content security policy for your website is something fairly personal. It's something that's fairly unique to your site. You have to decide what you want your CSP to be. And CSP is fairly complicated. There's a lot of varying options. The browsers support different things. And you have to really understand what the various things means and how they interact to know what to write for your site. If we just said, oh yeah, CSP is there now, and you add it, and like the whole site breaks, because it's not just like a manifest that tells the browser what you have. Like, the browser acts on it. If it says don't allow JavaScript unless it's from this domain, your site just stops working if you haven't done the work to actually be in compliance with the policy. It's similar to the GDPR thing. Like, in that case, we had a whole bunch of things that we had to do to get a nicer end-to-end experience regarding tracking user consent, providing some type of UI that says you have consent or not, plugging that into the concept of essential cookies with a middleware and a tracking consent feature, yada, yada, yada. For content security policy, I haven't yet seen a proposal that says, this is the set of features we really need to make content security policy flexible enough but simple to solve all the problems. So far, it seems to be, yeah, you just have to decide what you want your content security policy for your site to be, and then you have to do the work to adhere to how strict you make. I'm sure you can find articles that are like, this is the best practice for CSP, and it probably locks down everything so that it's not like the web that you grew up with over the last 20 years. Like, you have to go through and change a whole bunch of stuff about your site. It'd be interesting to see if Nick has opinions. He's already talking about it. Because I know the journey that Nick Nick and Stack Overflow went through just to get things like HTTPS working. So they were HTTPS everywhere. That was a 2-year journey or more for them, right? CSP seems to be a similar level thing. Like, you could add the most basic things, I guess. You could say, well, I'm already compliant with these things. I could just add a policy that says that. I'd have to do any work. Sure, that helps a little bit. It obviously reduces some vectors for things to sneak in that you weren't aware of. But it's not a turnkey feature. So I guess it's the short way of saying a very long thing.
That seems like something that you could do by profiling an application and seeing what requests are made.
Absolutely. You know the way to do that, though. you just turn on CSP at the strongest level, and then you open the browser tools and look at all the errors that Chrome spits out for you. It'll tell you when the site's trying to do something that's violated.
So that shows me a bunch of errors that I have to fix, but it would seem like the next level up is I want an extension that generates a CSP for me.
Yeah.
I click around the site and it like sees what requests are made and just says, here's your CSP.
Yeah. But if there isn't already an issue that exists, I'd love for one to be created, and then for folks in the community and our customers to offer their feedback about what they would want a CSP feature. What does that even mean? What would a CSP feature in ASP.NET Core do? Right? How flexible would it be? What would the default experience be? What would it even do? And someone who really understands CSP, who has gone through the journey of applying it to their own site. With all the wrinkles and warts and all the rest of it, and then we could maybe figure out whether that's something that's worthwhile doing the work on. All right, what else?
Oh, so sorry, Sean did say that in the chat that you can turn on CSP report only. Mm-hmm. Is a nice way to apply it without breaking anything.
Cool.
Yeah. As a side note, that is something I recently for .NET Foundation we've been sending out all these emails. And they look like automated emails because we're sending out to all these members as they join. And so somebody, Robert McClaws, was like, hey, you got to check your email headers. And I went through and set up all the things. There's DMARC and there's all the policy headers that you have to set up. A similar sort of thing where you can turn them on in a monitor mode.
Right.
And you can see what breaks. Yep. And then you can firm them up.
Right.
So.
Vladislav asks, with Razor components in the same project, what is envisaged switch from RC to Blazor, Razor components to Blazor? Okay, so this is a question, it seems like, about what would it take to switch an application that was built using Razor components to being one that runs as a Blazor. The best way to see that is to install the latest Blazor experimental release, because their projects are set up that way by default now. You can do a Blazor, I think they have a template in the box that is one that is set up like that, where the components are in a separate project, and then you have a project that's server-side and a project that's client-side, or it's a project that is one that's very easy to switch between client rendering and server rendering. And so the goal and the intent is for that process to be very simple. Obviously, once you go to client-side rendering, you get a whole bunch of other benefits, in the sense that you're now doing all that, you're running all that code, that event handling code locally. But I do want to reiterate every time we talk about this, that building the Razor components programming model is nothing like the Razor views and pages programming model. They're both Razor syntax, like they're both C# mixed with HTML, and they share directive names and whatnot. But Razor views and pages is very much about the request response HTTP style, where you go to a server, it gets processed, and you return a response. Razor components is not that. Razor components is event handling, right? It's very much designed around stateful UI paradigm, so which is what you see in Spars, right? Because it's running locally. When you run Razor components without a Blazor runtime, without a WebAssembly, then you're running using this component circuit feature where all the rendering is running remotely, that the engine is actually running on the server. It's running on the other side of the connection, right? And in .NET Core 3, it means it's running in your ASP.NET Core application. And then it gets sent down, all those interactions get sent over the WebSocket. I have seen some people say, well, that sounds like WebForms. You're not wrong. It is actually very similar to WebForms. It's just using technology that's 20 years newer, so it's 1,000 times better. Because you just have, there's no state round tripping anymore. You just have an active WebSocket connection. So you don't have that view state bloat problem that you used to have. You have other issues that you need to deal with, but it's a very nice programming model. So yes, they are different programming models. One is a stateful programming model for stateful UI architectures, and the other one is the request response designed around request response. So it's worthwhile making sure people understand the difference. Will Swagger, it's a question from Sebastian. Will Swagger support OpenID Connect? So let me see if I'm interpreting this correctly. I believe the Swagger and OpenAPI spec now supports the concept of knowing that an endpoint is authorized, and then the Swagger client that gets generated can be hooked up to an OpenID Connect server such that the built-in client can authorize, right? So you bring up the Swagger UI, you want to test the API, but that requires authorization because the backend is authenticated. The Swagger UI does that for you. We've only had a cursory look at that, but that's certainly the goal, is that when we get to the point that you can file new ASP.NET Core API application that it includes the OpenAPI endpoints for you as an option, and that if you've turned on authorization as part of that, that all just works, right? That is certainly the intent, but I don't have any further detail for you other than that at the moment, but it's good to hear a question on that. Are you seeing any questions in Twitch? I'm looking at YouTube just at the moment.
Sorry, let me look. I didn't see any on Facebook yet, but we do have steady. We have some people watching. I don't see any questions on Twitch.
Okay. I see. Are the new worker service template blogs imminent? That's from Greg. Glenn is planning to do a series of blog posts about the new worker service template. It was alluded to in the blog post that you showed from Dan before. He's committing to doing a series of 3 or 4 blog posts, I think it was. I put a number on it. There you go, Glenn, if you're watching. There's 3 or 4 now. To do with how to use the worker service template to then build an app that does certain things, like how do I host it in a Windows service? How do I host it as a service on Linux using SysD or whatever it was, SystemD? How do I use it to dequeue something and blah, 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 blah. So he is writing those blog posts, as I understand it. I think we're going to see the first one of those drop this week, and then there'll be one after that, et cetera, et cetera. I think we're doing a similar series for gRPC as well, if I recall. Rory asks, I've got a link query that causes a Stack Overflow in EF Core 2.2 and 3.0 previews, but only when running under IIS. It works under Kestrel or in a console app. What is the best place to log an issue? So my gut is telling me that that's a stack size issue. Mm-hmm. So when you run your application in ASP.NET Core in IIS, if you're running in process, in IIS's worker process, which is the support we introduced in 2.2, and it's the default in 2.2 and 3.0 when you publish to IIS, the stack size is determined by IIS, not by the .NET host. Okay? And the stack size is different between the two. I think in the .NET host, the normal Windows console app, stack size is a megabyte, but in IIS Express, I think it's 256 kilobytes for 32-bit and 512 for 64-bit. I might be remembering those numbers wrong. Which means that if you have certain types of code, you can hit stack limits when running in IIS that you don't hit when you're running as in Kestrel as a .NET Core. You can run them in IIS out of process and you won't hit those limits. So that's the easy way to know or to further check whether that's the issue is change your hosting model to be out of process instead of in process. And if the app works in IIS, then it's likely that it's a stack limit that you're hitting. So log that bug. If it is that, then the bug could be logged. I would log it on EF Core because it could be that the EF Core team could reduce the complexity of the generated code that link query is turning into, the expression that gets built, that could then reduce the stack. But they may not be able to. It all depends on what you're doing. I would just encourage people to log the bugs wherever they think, and then they'll get moved if they're in the wrong place, right? Like, there's only 3 repos now anyway. There's extensions, ASP.NET Core, and any framework core. So that is my hunch of what that is, though. And then Yanni's just pointing out that, yes, we had the worker service demo on a community standup. Yeah, Glenn came and showed that at some point, if I recall, which is great. That's in there. So I see Mahia is asking, will system drawing be supported for ASP.NET Core? We touched on this last week when David was here. So system drawing as it stands right now as a compact pack package, I don't think is technically supported at all. It's available as part of the Windows compatibility package, the Windows compatibility pack, which has a different support agreement to the rest of .NET Core. And that's something that we're actually looking at as part of .NET Core 3, whether that needs to be revisited. The system.drawing in particular has often been a problem for server applications because of the nature of GDI on Windows, which is what system drawing calls into, is not particularly well suited to server applications because it takes locks that are vastly too coarse to be stable and performant and reliable and scalable in a web application. And so our general guidance has always been system.drawing is not supported in ASP.NET, so use at your own risk. In the case of the new system drawing that's ported for .NET Core, when you're running on Windows, it still uses GDI. When you're running on non-Windows platforms, it uses a mono implementation of system.drawing that relies, I believe, on Skia Sharp, which is Skia's the native image manipulation library that's written in C++, I believe. I don't have any knowledge about whether that is better or worse. I'm assuming it doesn't have the global sort of lock problems that system drawing. I don't actually know. We don't have an official statement of support regarding that. So I will take that question, and I will try and get back to you with a better answer than that. We don't have any good answer for that right now. So question from Demeter, any plans to have better integration with popular frameworks like React and Vue? By better, I mean seamless integration through NPM packages like ASP.NET, React, blah, blah, ASP.NET, Vue. So we've talked about this a couple of times. Our SPA integration today, we have the SPA services package and features. So we have the Node services and the SPA services that build on top of that, which enables you to host Node on the server next to your ASP.NET Core application and then do interop between them by calling methods back and forth. That's the low level. And then we build the SPA services stuff on top of that, where we have a first-class experience for Angular, React, and Redux. And those ship as templates that you can use that are supported by us. We don't have any plans to support Vue right now. It's very expensive to add a new JavaScript framework like that for us to support as a top-level thing. And so we encourage the community to go and fork one of our existing ones and build whatever you think is the best one for whatever JavaScript framework you're into. If our telemetry and the requests channels demonstrate that one of the other frameworks that we do support has dropped in usage significantly and there's another one that has taken its place, then we'll look at that as an option. But right now, that's not what those things are showing us. Beyond that, those templates basically are set up where you've got the SPA application using whatever the framework is in its own folder, so it's somewhat pure. And then you've got the ASP.NET Core app sort of around it, like a donut, which hosts it and integrates the Webpack middleware and gives you a nice dev workflow set up and a publish pipeline for those things. That all works. We don't have any plans to go beyond that and do any more integration. That's kind of the level of integration we have today, and we have a lot of folks using it. It seems to be working quite well. What else we got?
There's a question about grant types for the new identity server integration, implicit flow or other.
Okay. So yeah, we only have one credential flow that we've supported right now, which is the one that's used by the SPA flow. And I can't remember what it is. It's an OpenID Connect JWT token based flow. The one that I really want to get is the client credential flow next to support app to app and service to server. Support. We don't have any. I don't think we're going to get that done in 3.0. If nothing else, I'd love for us to get, some docs or maybe a template created that at least, even if we don't have the wonderful glue done, we can at least show you where on the identity server docs to go and read to get that stuff set up properly. We do intend to do some stuff.
That brings up an issue. Maybe we should have Barry or somebody on to talk about just identity, like recent identity updates and changes and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we absolutely could. There was a question above that. I thought, request. Amine, I think that's how you pronounce your name. Please, guys, need IntelliSense for .razor files and VS Code. It's coming. So there was an announcement actually that the C# extension is going to be getting a better Razor support very soon. We've had some experimental CSHTML support in there for a few months now. I believe the next release they're going to officially change the support to alpha, and that whatever that means to you. The team is working actively on getting the Razor component support into there. So I think the last time I heard they were getting tag helper support and IntelliSense stood up inside Razor component and Razor in VS Code, and the Razor component and Razor components will be coming up in there shortly after that as well. So what else have we got?
There's maybe one last one here. Raphael is asking. He said Emma Landworth created an issue on Corfex repo to enable SIMD for JSON API for 3.0. Is this a top priority for 3.0? Is she labeled?
No. Not that I'm aware of. So the JSON stuff, as we know, the system text JSON, which is landing in NetCore 3, is the new platform level JSON API that's super fast and all the rest of it. Supporting SIMD would be great if it doesn't already. I think I thought it was already using some intrinsics, but maybe it's not. SIMD are the processor instructions that allow single instruction, multiple data, I think it means, where you can do parallelization through a single CPU instruction for, we use it a lot throughout Kestrel to get for parsing and whatnot to get improved performance. And he says Tech and Power Fortune's benchmark is the next target. So we already did a lot of work on the Tech and Power Fortune benchmark. That one doesn't use JSON. Tech and Power Fortune is a database benchmark, and we're like number 7, I think, on the list. And the holding back factor now isn't anything to do with the framework code. It's to do with the database driver and supporting pipelining and batching. Which we are looking at doing. The EF team, which is also the ADO.NET team, is doing investments in supporting batching and pipelining in the ADO.NET driver layer, which will allow us to then catch back up to the very, very top results in that, that use those features inside for protocols that support them. So the Postgres protocol supports this concept of pipelining. For the JSON test in Tech and Power, the problem is not the JSON serializer. As that is, the reason we aren't in the top 10 in the JSON test on Tech and Power is not because our JSON parser or serializer is slow. When we've used JSON.NET in there, which I think is what the official one does right now, and then we try using alternate JSON parsers, whether it's UTF-8 JSON or the new JSON parser and serializer in .NET Core 3, it is faster, but it is not why it's not in the top 10. Like, it gets us back a few percent. It's actually to do with our performance for non-pipelined requests, where you have a connection, and we've talked about this a lot on the stand-up over 4 years, right? But you have an HTTP 1.1 connection, you issue a request, and then the server issues you a response. And then you can issue a request, and then the server issues you a response. If you do it that way, that is non-pipelined. That's what browsers do today, in that they create multiple connections so that they can get parallelism of multiple requests at a time. Because with HTTP 1.1, you typically only send one request and you wait for a response before you send the next one, right? It's serial. Pipelining is when you send more than one request in sequence before you've received a response. Now, the spec allows that. So I can send you, you know, 10 requests, and then the server has to send you back those 10 responses in the same order as the requests that you sent them, if that makes sense, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the plain text scenario in Tech and Power does. It does a 16-depth pipelining, which is why those numbers are so high. The JSON test doesn't use pipelining, okay? So it's very much like plain text, except that it's not pipelined, and it adds a very simple JSON serialization task where you have to new up an object as a result of the request every single time. You can't reuse a shared object, and then you have to run that object through a JSON serializer, and it's a hello world object, okay? 16 in Tech and Power, Seb says. So if we had the fastest, like a zero cost JSON serializer, we still wouldn't be in the top 10, because the problem is when we just exercise our request response performance with no other work, there is some overhead in the system right now that we still haven't figured out. It's latency rather than overhead that is preventing us from going faster than a certain amount. And so we need to figure that out. We don't know what it is yet. It's not particularly problematic because there are no workloads where you just send request responses with no work. just shows up bad on that test. So it is not the performance of the JSON serializer that is causing us not to be top of the JSON test. It's just unfortunate that that's the first test where they turn off pipelining, and so it looks like we're really slow in JSON, but it's actually not what it is. It's just because of what it is. Anyway, so we'll continue to work through that over the coming years, and we'll figure out if we can notch that one up a little bit so that we can look good on the benchmark, because I like looking good on benchmarks. It's always fun to do so. And Seb's adding a little bit more context here as well. What else? Samuel Alexander is asking about new laptop recommendations for software development. They all suck equally. I am never, ever happy. This is a great laptop. It's very expensive. It's very powerful. It's Lenovo X1 Extreme. It's got 12 cores in it or something ridiculous, 32 gigs of RAM, gorgeous 4K panel. And then I still get frustrated every day when something lags or doesn't work the way I expect it to. But I'm not a developer, so don't ask me my opinion anymore.
Do you work mostly on a laptop, or do you have a desktop?
Exclusively.
So I never I have a laptop that I can travel with, and I can hold my breath and get by with it for a bit.
Yeah.
But I've got three monitors on my desktop, and that's my life.
I have a dock, so to be clear, I don't usually use it as a laptop. At my desk here at work, I have a $400 Thunderbolt dock. That there's a Lenovo one that runs two 4K screens plus this screen. I think I can put another 4K screen if I want. So I have all the power to do that type of stuff. But what you're touching on is that desktops are still orders of magnitude faster. If you're a developer, you're going to have a much better time running on a desktop while you can. I understand not everyone can. I used to be a consultant. I understand. And so you can get powerful laptops. I'm also not a PC gamer, so I don't care at all about the graphics card from a gaming point of view. I just want my 4K panel to go fast. I want it to have the lowest heat and power draw as possible. I want all the things, right? I don't care about gaming though. And as Nick says, thermal throttling is what kills laptop performance. Like this laptop, because it has a dedicated GPU and an 8th generation hexa-core CPU, I think the CPU is a 45-watt part and the GPU is like another 60-watt part. So, you know, it's 105 watts at total load that it has to, of thermal wattage that it has to dissipate, as opposed to like a Surface Book or a quad-core part that's 15 watts or 25 watts TDP. Once you add those external GPUs, which a lot of laptops are doing now, because the panels are 4K and people want to be able to plug in an external panel, the embedded graphics just simply can't handle that. They're adding these external GPUs, and they do, you know, if you're doing video encoding and stuff, all that stuff helps as well, but they draw a lot of power. So battery impact, thermal impact, you can get this noisy neighbors of heat, so your GPU gets hot because it's doing work, which then slows down your CPU because the total thermal envelope is now being exceeded and you have to slow things down. Whereas in a desktop, you just don't have that problem.
Yeah.
You just don't have that problem. It's easy to add more cooling, get a bigger case, get more fans, get water cooling. Like, it doesn't matter, right? Yeah, and Sean's pointing out that the docking station that I use for this has two power supplies. When I got it, I was like, wait, are these like optional? I get to choose which power supply? No. There's a 230-watt power supply that you plug in that is a direct throughput into the laptop. It doesn't actually power the dock. And then there's another like 75-watt power supply, I think, that just powers the dock. This power supply that I'm running off now is 135 watts for this.
You need
this
a separate
laptop.
Breaker panel.
It's crazy. And this is for a freaking laptop, right? It's nuts. But yeah, my general advice is that if you're a developer, I recommend a desktop. If you can't use a desktop, then get ready to compromise.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
There was maybe one other, I don't know.
Ooh, you don't know if you should, okay, go on.
Well, there was a question in here about integrating identity with Razer Pages. I don't know if we've...
I'm not quite sure what that means.
Oh, did you already do that? Integrate identity with Razer Components?
That's different. So Razer Pages and Razer Components are different. Yeah, so we one of the features we plan to do, obviously, is have a story for having a Razer Components app that has auth, right? How to authenticate, how to use identity. The current plan of record is effectively that you'll be able to, when you create a Razer Components app, you'll be able to say, yes, I want identity and authentication. That will be using the existing identity UI package that we have, which is actually Razer Pages internally. So it's like a separate island inside your app, right? And so you'll go log in your Razer Components app. It'll bounce you over, do a redirect to the registration or a login page. You'll log in, and then it will bounce you back to the Razer Components part of your app. And then just like a spa, you'll then have some primitives that we'll make for you in Razer Components that you can use to like control authorization. Like, how do you say that this page needs this, that you need to be signed in, and what's the policy you need, and how do you show the username and all that type of stuff, right? So I believe that we're doing, Steve is working on a proposal for that right now, but I can't remember if it's shipping in preview 4, it's being designed in preview 4 and shipping in preview 5, I can't remember. But yes, it's being worked on right now. So Vladislav is saying that my camera has massive chromatic aberration.
Wow.
So I'll pass that on to Golnaz because I don't know anything about that. Otherwise, it's time for us to finish. It's been over an hour.
I think so. Yes.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us today.
Yes, including thank you to the, well, we've seen
Facebook.
Now there are two now, but we had up to like 9, I think. So.
Wow.
Wonderful.
Look at that.
All the places.
New audience over on Facebook. So fantastic.
Hooray.
All right. We will see everyone. We got MVP Summit next week, so we're not going to be doing the show, right? So no show next week. So we'll be back here in 2 weeks' time.
2 weeks. Awesome. Okay.
Thanks, everyone.